Morning.
I'd like to bring this meeting on Wednesday, February 14th of the Fisheries Committee to order. Present are Representative Johnson, Representative Edgman, myself, Representative Seaton. Two other representatives are in finance subcommittees and are on their way. We are not having to wait for a quorum because we do not have legislation considering today. We are having a presentation on the 2006 Susitna Sockeye Salmon Project from the Cooking and Aquaculture and probably from Fish and Game as well. And so is there anything that anybody wants to bring before the committee before we start the presentation? Seeing nothing? Let's see, would you like to come forward, Trent?
Sure.
And would you introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and go ahead with your presentation?
Sure. Trent Dodson, biologist for the Cooking and Aquaculture Association.
And Trent, do you want us to wait until your presentation is done if we have questions, or should we interrupt as you go?
I think we could ask questions as I go. I don't think that'll be a problem.
And I'm going to slide around here to the side.
I'll start off just by just giving a brief history of sort of how we got to this point. The latter part of 2005, the association expressed some interest in conducting some investigative work on several of the lakes in the Susitna system, put a proposal together, talked with several folks from Fish and Game, found that some of the proposals they were putting together meshed quite well with the ones that we were putting together. And so sort of integrated our project with their project, came up with a memorandum of understanding, and sort of started working from the first part of, or I guess the middle part of 2006, starting in July. The first project that Fish and Game is doing that we found that we sort of meshed well with was one that Mark Ouellette of Fish and Game is doing, and that's the evaluation of sockeye salmon production from lakes in the Susitna River watershed. And this was very closely related to what we were looking for. You can see in the red there the areas that Cook and the Aquaculture Association will do in this project, or has done in this project. And these three points come directly from the work plan that Mark Ouellette submitted. The first there is to collect limnological samples from seven lakes in the Susitna area, and then compare those to limnological samples that were collected throughout the 80s and the 90s. So that this part of the project, we went out and collected the samples, turned those over to Fish and Game, and they will analyze those samples. And I talked with Mark Ouellette, and those samples should be available by next week. So we will have some results on that for the first part of the project. The project is over a three-year span, so this is just a little snapshot of what we are actually anticipating to get. The samples were collected in August and September.
And when you get those data back, can you send the Fisheries Committee a summary on that?
You bet. We sure will. Okay. Yep. The second part of the project is solely what Fish and Game will be doing or has done. And that is doing hydroacoustics surveys in all of the lakes to get a feel of how many juvenile salmon are in the lake at that time. And those would be fish that have hatched the previous spring. So they did these surveys this fall, so those were fish that would have hatched in the spring of 2006, as well as probably some age 2 and age 1 sockeye from previous hatches. And then part 3, to evaluate the survival rates from our adult weir counts this year, Fish and Game will be able to get an estimate of the potential egg deposition that those fish would have put in the system. Then next year, when they do their fall fry counts, they can get a survival rate of those eggs to the fall fry. Then we will do smolt counts at these lakes, and we can get a fry to smolt survival based on the data that we collect and the age structures that we find in those populations. Then we can compare those to other lakes that we have lots of data on primarily lakes in the lower peninsula, or I guess in the Kenai Peninsula. Hidden Lake would be one that we've collected extensive data on. We have many survival rates from fry to smolt in those lakes, such as Bear Lake would be another example, Big Lake would be another one. So we can compare these survival rates to those lakes, similar lakes, and see if there's any problems going on with survival. The second fish and game project that we tied in with quite well was the River Sockeye, or Soon Sitting the River Sockeye Escapement Abundance Project, and that's the one that with the pit tags, and we will be doing the second part there. We will estimate age, sex, and length composition of the population of adult sockeye salmon migrating from Flathorn at Chilatna, Hewitt Shell, Judd Byers, Stefan, and Larson Lakes. And that's what we've just done this past summer. We had weirs at these lakes, enumerated the fish, or the sockeye salmon fish going into the lakes, took age, weight, length samples as the population migrated into the lake, and turned those samples over to Fish and Game. They were able to turn that around, and we got the age structure, the average length. We got that within weeks of turning in the data, and so we do have those results now. I believe Fish and Game is here, so they can talk probably more of the specifics of the of how the Escapement Abundance Project went. But the red is primarily what I wanted to highlight, that what we're working on right now in conjunction with them. For those of you that aren't familiar with the Cook Inlet area as such, this is the entire drainage of the Cook Inlet area, and the area that we'll be working in is the Sioux Sitting area, and that's all of the area above the jagged red line. And I'll just zoom in on that. This might be kind of hard to see. There's a lot of creeks and watersheds up there. This is the entire watershed of the Sioux Sitting area. You can see a faint jagged red line there on the right, and the area above that is thought to be devoid of salmon altogether. All of that watershed, and I wish I had a pointer, all of that watershed drains through one point called Devil's Canyon, and it's thought that the water and the elevation is too rough that salmon can't go up. So that whole area over there has no salmon, maybe a few kings, but all other species don't exist in that area. The first point I wanted to show on the map was where Fish and Game did do their tagging stations, four wheels at Flathorn. They were able to capture fish, tag them with pit tags, and release them. The second two sites, one at the Yetna and one on the Sunshine Station of the Sioux Sitna River, they had two fish wheels operating, were able to recapture fish that they had tagged at Flathorn, as well as tag fish that that were not tagged at Flathorn, release those fish as well. We had weirs at Byers Lake, Chilatna Lake, Hewitt Lake, Judd Lake, Larson Lake, Shell Lake, and we were supposed to have a weir at Stefan Lake. We ran into some permitting issues regarding the land use around that lake. Weren't sure who owned the land. We did submit permits to Department of Natural Resources. They weren't quite sure who had the land. Found out it was owned by Siri. By the time we had tracked down how we would get permits and who Siri had leased the land to or sold the land to, it was mid-August, and we figured by then, by the time everything fell into place, we really wouldn't be able to get much data out of there. So we scrubbed that one for this year. The permits are in, and we will plan on going up there to do the smolt count. So we were able to have weirs at the four lakes on the Yetna side and only two of the three lakes on the Sioux Sitna side. The first lake.
And can you,
oh, sure.
Can you back up?
There you
go. So the Yetna was number two?
Two, yes.
Okay. And so you had four fish wheels at Flathorn?
Correct.
And two at, yeah.
And two at Sunshine. And those were Fish and Game's recapture and then mark stations as well. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let the record reflect that Representative Newman has joined the committee.
Were those fish wheels due to the funds that were appropriated last year?
That I can't answer. That's probably a fishing game would be able to answer that better.
They are online and
oh.
We'll get.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Okay, the first lake I wanted to talk a bit about was Chilatna Lake. This is the largest lake in the system that we had a weir at. We counted just over 13,000 sockeye salmon. We were able to recover 81 pit tags, and we did collect 130 age samples and 130 genetic samples. The age samples, as I said before, were sent to Fish and Game for analysis, as well as the genetic samples.
Can you, for the committee and those people watching and listening,
sure,
back up just a little bit and explain pit tags and how they're recovered and what they look like?
Sure. The pit tag essentially is a small piece of glass that looks about like a piece of rice. There's a small transmitter in there that when it passes through the antennas that we have at the weirs will become excited and spit out a specific number encoded in each of the tags. When Fish and Game tags them at the fish wheels, they are essentially injecting them with a syringe in the cheek area of the fish. We have, depending on the location and which weir we're at, we will have either a handheld wand that looks like a small tennis racket or a large rectangular antenna integrated right into the weir that the fish will swim through. So when that electronic field is passed over the tag, it will read it and put it into a computer. We had laptops out there and readers, and those numbers would get stored.
So is this similar to the radio frequency tags that they're talking about using on groceries and everything else? I mean,
that I don't know, the RFID stuff.
Yeah, so
it could be essentially. I mean, we just for an anecdotal, we had a one of our interns swallow one, and then you could scan his torso and it read it. So I suppose if you embedded it into a human, you
was the big intern.
You could.
Isn't it strange that it was an intern that got that job?
Give it to Mike.
So it's probably quite similar to that. Yeah.
Okay, and what is PIT?
Passive integrated transponder.
Okay. Passive integrated
transponder. That's what the acronym is.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And what's the difference between a
Representative
PIT tag?
Johnson.
I'm sorry, thank you. What's the difference between a PIT tag and a radio tag?
Well, the radio tags, the radio tag's quite larger. It has an antenna on it, and that will go down the esophagus of the fish. That when they would catch at the fish wheel, they would actually insert it down the throat. To detect those, they would have to set up antennas at different points, and I believe they also flew over the area where it with whatever it is that they used, a transponder, I believe, to find these tags, and it would actually create a blip, and then they could tell where the fish was in the system. And I believe that part of the project was more or less to find out where the fish were ultimately ending up and where they were spawning.
Okay, so just to clarify, then the PIT tags were used when they went through a weir, and then you would be able to automatically or with a wand identify that those fish had been caught and tagged down at the fish wheels, and the radio frequency ones were kind of like the moose satellite tags or something.
Correct.
Moose collars that would, whether it was satellite or other receptors, would tell where that fish was at any particular time.
Any given moment, correct. And we had no means to do that. That was totally a fishing game exercise. But we did detect the pit tags at the weirs, and those have to be within a foot or 2 feet of the antenna in order to actually be detected.
And
so that's why we would pass them through the integrated antenna.
And so you had a antenna loop or integrated antenna or whatever it is.
Correct.
And all the fish went through those, through that area in the weir, is that?
Correct. At the weirs that we had those, of the weirs that we had set up, Chilatna Larson and Judd had that sort of antenna. The others, we had to hand scan them.
And I guess I'm trying to figure out. So the pit tags at Gelatina, Judd, and Larson were 100% scanned, all the fish that went through.
Correct.
Was 100% of the fish that went through the other ones, were they scanned? Or?
No, I believe it was anticipated, and past data had showed that Shell Lake had relatively small returns. And as I get to that, you'll see that almost 70,000 fish came to Shell Lake and 14,000 in one day. So it was impossible for the crew to scan every single fish. So only one pit tag was detected there. We have met with Mark Ouellette and Fish and Game. He's the one that set up all of these antennas for us. He flew out after the camps were established and set up all the antennas, trained the crew how to use the tags and or the readers and the computers and so forth. And he is going to get us a antenna that the fish swim through for that particular lake.
Okay. And in the presentation here, did all the weirs look basically like this?
No. Each system, depending on the creek, had to have a different weir. For the most part, the area of the weir that you see going towards the shore, that's quite similar between most of the weirs. Lake Creek, which drains Gelatina Lake, is a well-traveled lake for rafters. So this corner of the picture, you can see a gate made out of PVC pipe that floats, but yet still blocks fish from passing, and the rafts rather are able to just go right over it. This particular weir, as well as the Hewitt weir, which is a different design altogether, but also had to have a gate because of the boat traffic in and out of Hewitt Lake.
So we're not seeing over to the right hand side?
No, that's here. About 180 feet long. That's by far the largest weir that we had. Most of the others were between, I'd say, 60 and 70 feet. Larson Lake was probably the smallest weir at probably 40 feet.
And is the antenna, where would that be in this?
You can't see it. It's off to this side. I do have a picture of it later on when we get to the Larson Lake slide. I have a picture of what the antenna looks like.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Newman.
Just for your clarification on those weirs, too, on the Deshka and Manny Rivers where they're used, it's the PVC pipe bends over and it floats in the water, so motorized traffic can go both ways on it too.
Yeah, it does have a bend on the one side so the boat can come back through. Yeah. One thing I did want to point out about Gelatina, and we did have problems there with some high water issues in the beginning. That's why on the curve there you don't see us actually counting till the 27th. The water level came to the point where we couldn't get in it to work to put the weir in. And then likewise, at the end, the water levels came up and actually knocked the weir over. We've had some discussions about it, and I think what we are planning on doing to prevent that from happening, obviously you can see low areas, higher pickets should help. And on each of those tripods, there's a sandbag on a cross member to hold the wood down. I think if we get rid of that, put the sandbags at the top, there'll be less resistance in the water, and it should hold it up. This is a project that Cookinut Aquaculture has done in the 90s, and I think that was the method they used. They had flooding before, but not to that extent. So I think that's something that we are going to look at to try and prevent so we can get a better count there next year.
So the sandbags are behind those kind of tripods that are...
Yeah, there? They're on a 2x4 that goes across, and so when the water level came up, those went underwater, and the resistance knocked the sandbag off, and that wood just floated right up and it brought it down. So I think we're pretty confident we can correct that by changing that design.
Okay.
The next lake is Hewitt Lake. This was another lake that we had to put a weir in with a gate. The gate was actually operated manually. There was high boat traffic on this particular creek simply because there's several houses and cabins on Hewitt Lake, and it's a really big place for pike fishing. And one thing that we figure might be affecting the population there, just from talking with the folks that live on the lake, is that the pike population has taken off at this lake, and it's a great habitat for pike pike. Stagnant water, real warm lake, weedy, muddy areas all along, and we would actually see pike migrating up with salmon at the weir. So that's an issue that we're going to look at. We were able to collect 115 age samples, 65 genetic samples. This was a handheld scanner. We did get 3 pit tags, however, and just about 2,500 sockeye salmon at this particular lake. The next lake is Shell Lake. This was the one where we had a very surprisingly high sockeye return, almost 70,000 fish. We were able to get 587 age samples. All of our genetic samples that the Fish and Game wanted, we did get those. But unfortunately, like I said before, we did have a handheld scanner. We were not able to scan every fish, very few fish. I think only the ones that we did our samples on were we able to scan. So we only recovered 1 pit tag, and talks with Mark Letta Fish and Game that we should get that swim-through antenna up there and get better data for him.
Yes. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shell Lake has pike in it.
Yes.
So the assumption that the pike eat a lot of the smelt or the fry.
Sure.
Because there's such a remarkable high sockeye run in here, how do you account for that?
Well, I don't know. I know there's pike in there. That's what we've been told. Never saw any in the creek. We'll have to see from the smolt count what kind of smolt we get from this return. We should get that, boy, next year. So we'll get the fry count from Fish and Game, and then our smolt count as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, and maybe a Fish and Game Sport Fish Division can give us an estimate of the relative estimate of pike in the different lake systems. That'd be probably what you're asking for.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just know that the pike have been blamed for a lot of the loss of salmon fry or smolt, I don't see that when I look at Shell Lake, I guess.
Sure, and the returns could be greater given that the predation isn't as great, but we won't know until we see what the actual smolt count is from this particular escapement.
Okay. And this particular escapement is presumed to be much higher than in the past, but
correct.
They didn't have a weir in the past.
I don't believe so. I believe it was mostly stream surveys, aerial surveys. 1 year they did estimate 45,000 fish returned to this lake. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but for the most part it was less than 5,000.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
The next lake is Judd Lake. This lake yielded 40,000 sockeye salmon. We did get all of our age samples and genetic samples. We did recover 51 pit tags. And you can see this is a great curve as far as the population run. I think we were able to pretty much get every fish there. One thing from discussions with Mark Willett of Fish and Game, we will probably stay at these sites all the way through August. We were working with mostly college students that did have to get back to class, so that's why we had to pull most of these weirs, and we did. Right now, going through the application process for the new interns coming in, we have several students that will be able to stay all the way to September. That will be very helpful. We will probably also man those weirs ourselves, maybe through the first week of September, just to get a better count for the pit tags. I believe some of these weirs we pulled few days after they tagged fish down at the fish wheels, and so those fish were never recovered. And so I think a timing issue came into play, and we need to stay at the sites quite a bit longer than we were. Byers Lake is on the state park there for Denali. You can see from the curve, we were probably there a lot earlier than we needed to be. This is also, this is one of the northernmost lakes, so that doesn't surprise me. We will stay there definitely longer than the 15th next year and see if we can't count some more fish through there. We did get 3,000, which was right about what Fish and Game estimated would come back, between 3,000 and 5,000. We did get a few samples there. We had several issues with catching fish. We also, as you can see from the aerial photo, were near a footbridge. We had to camp a quarter mile from the site itself, and hikers would come by there, see the weir, maybe not understand what it was, and open it. So for next year, the creek kind of curves over there to the right. We're going to move the weir down around that corner, out of sight. We'll also do the smolt count there this spring. The last lake I have to show is Larson Lake. We had a very good escapement there, 56,000. Once again, we got 600 age samples, 200 genetic samples, and this by far was our most productive site as far as recovering pit tags, almost 700 pit tags, and we did see one radio tag. Once again, the curve there is pretty good. We could probably go in a little later than what we did last year, but I think for the most part, the timing was pretty good on this particular site. There is a photo of the swim-through antenna. It's the black structure there. It has to be insulated by those wood walls so that it doesn't interfere with the metal of the, or the aluminum in the metal of the weir itself. So it's sort of like a little chute. The fish are coming up. That's Josh standing there. The fish are coming up from behind him. They'll go through the weir. They'll enter that box and then through the antenna.
Did you have much accumulation downstream of these at all?
I don't believe so. I think they were passed in a pretty timely manner. The particular day I was at Shell Lake was the day they had the most fish. We had actually gone out there to take out a beaver dam. The day before, they had zero fish. There was a beaver dam downstream, and all the fish were backed up behind it. By the time we had gotten there, it looked like a bear or something had been on the dam, broke it down, and all the fish came up all at once. And so the creek was completely full of fish, and that's basically all we did the rest of the day was pass those fish through. Other than that, I'm not sure how much of an accumulation we had behind many of these weirs for an extended period of time.
Is there any information on the effect of beaver dams on any of these runs up there?
I don't know. Maybe I could yield that to Gary.
Yeah. We can have him come up and
later.
Maybe address that later.
Sure.
As far as
he does most of the work with the beaver dams for us. So. I put together just a quick summary of sort of where we were and what we found. I put over there on the far right of all of the lakes the age breakdown of the three major age classes regarding the scale samples we took that Fish and Game did process for us. An interesting thing about Chilatna, you can see, is they do have a zero freshwater component. That you read the age there would be 0-3. That meant it spent 0 years in freshwater, so it basically went out the same year it hatched, and 3 years in salt water. And what's good about this is we can see what the major age classes are, and now we sort of know what the major age classes of smolt going out will be this coming spring, and we can see if that lines up good with what we found here. The Yetna count there is the count that Fish and Game posted on their website from the sonar counter. So,
for clarification, then the sonar count at Yetna was 92,000, and you had a.
It's roughly 120.
20
or so, yeah.
So that you actually.
We
counted in just these, like.
Yes.
Is that all of the?
No, there's
lake system in the Sioux City.
No, there's many, many lake systems. How big a producers they are, I don't know. But those were the four major lakes that, when we talked with Fish and Game, that they wanted the data on. So those were where we went.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Could you explain to me the 11%? Would you kind of walk through what the 11.38.49 in the Chiletno?
Oh, sure,
can
yeah.
Can you kind of tell me what those mean? And
yeah, so of the samples that we took for age, 11% of those samples, when they read the scale, were 0.3s. 0.3 is a fish that spent basically 0 years in fresh water and 3 years in salt water.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
That's not a 0.3. That's zero. That's a ratio.
Correct. Okay. So the age class below it is a fish that spent 1 year in fresh water. So it was a 1 year smolt when it migrated and came back after 2 years in salt water.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Okay. So, I mean, we've got a pretty good variation here between like Shell and Hewitt. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Hewitt is showing 3/4 of the fish were 1 year in fresh water and 3 years in salt water.
Correct.
Whereas in out of Shell Lake, we have over 80%. The 1 year is only 2 years in salt water. So is there any kind of feeling for the explanation for this, you know, quite diverse amount of time that they're spending in fresh water from the different lakes?
Well, I think it varies. Could be genetic. It could be that's if you took Hewitt Lake fish and put them somewhere else, that trend may occur as well. Oftentimes, too, you'll see the larger the smolt that go out, the sooner they'll come back. We see that quite often at Hidden Lake, where the smolt are quite large, most of those come back as two ocean fish, as opposed to, say, a Tustamina Lake, where the fish are smaller, they tend to come back. The age classes tend to be a little more even between the two ocean and the three ocean. So that could be something that's playing a part, too. What it is exactly, I don't know.
And maybe Fish and Game, when they're talking to us, can give us a little better handle on that day.
And interestingly, those two lakes are about 4 miles apart, so they're relatively close to one another.
So it could be, and those lakes, appreciated you providing the depth and size of the lake and those kind of things on some of them. So it could also be water quality or amount of feed or
sure.
Any of those things.
Sure, and those are the results that we're looking to get back here in the next week or so from Fish and Game. And then we'll continue that through May, June, July, August, September of this coming year, too.
Good. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that's markedly noticeable here is the lack of chum. You know, Chiletna Lake, one chum to 13,000 sockeye. You know, one chum to 2,000 Hewitt, one chum, you know, to 69,000 in Shell Lake.
Right.
You know, chums play a tremendous part of the ecological environment there, you know, with the bears that feed on them. I mean, when they deteriorate after they've spawned out for fish and what they do there. And then it's a huge concern of our local Fish and Game Advisory Committees on that, of what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you have an explanation, or maybe the Fish and Game guys can talk about that.
Fish and Game may know more about that. What I would probably see from, at least from our weirs, is I don't know if we were in there long enough to enumerate a substantial number of chums. I believe they would come in a little bit later than what the sockeye did. I suppose if we stayed in there a lot longer, we would see more cohos as well and so forth. Not to say that there's a great number of chums, I'm just saying I think we probably would have counted more had we stayed in there through September, October.
Okay, and let's ask Fish and Game to respond to that timing issue or if they have any when we're through here. Yeah, this is good. We appreciate this. It'll give us some real information.
Great. The last slide I just wanted to show was essentially where we are as far as the funding that we did receive from the state how our budget is tracking. The first section up there, I put what our budget is or what our proposed budgets were for each phase of the project. You can see the first fiscal year budget's quite a bit larger than the last two, and that's simply because the first year you're getting gear, building traps, building weirs, and so forth, and that upfront cost is what you see there reflected there. To date, we've spent $148,000 roughly on the adult weirs, and so we'll look to spend the rest of that here on the upcoming spring doing the smolt traps. As far as the funding sources go, and I apologize, I believe on your printout, the Cook and Aquaculture Association, I think that's a period instead of a comma. That should be $40,000 and not $40. We did receive money from Southeast Sustainable Salmon Fund on a yearly earmark. We allocated $210,000 to that. We received $200,000 from the state of Alaska. We requested $500,000 last year. We received $200,000. And so this coming year, we'll be requesting the final $300,000 to complete the three-year project. So that's sort of where we're sitting right now.
Okay, and just to break this down, I see that spent to date now. That was spent to date on the adult weirs, and then so before the end of the fiscal year, you'll spend the other portion of that on the smolt?
Correct. The smolt count, collecting water samples. We do have a contract with Fish and Game to analyze our samples that we pay them to do.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Newman.
On that funding, the state of Alaska, that request, because this was a three-year study, that is part of a $1 million grant that was forwarded last year that the legislators from the Sioux Valley were able to secure.
$1 million
for a three-year study, and then another $500,000 for what's called a fisherman satisfaction survey, where they'll go along, ask fishermen what they're catching and how they're doing.
And Representative Newman, I think we'll have to get some clarification from that, from not the biologist, but from maybe from Gary, from
sure.
CIA, can give us some clarification on that funding as well. Appreciate that. Well, good. I would just note for all presenters that if you do things in red and we get them in black and white, we lose the data. So whenever you're making a presentation, I mean, we get this all the time with economic charts, and they have colored, and then all of a sudden we can't tell where the bar graphs are because they didn't crosshatch them or something. So we're able to circle these here at this time, but for future reference, if most of us aren't using color printers. So.
Sure. But sorry about that.
No. Just, you know, if we don't let people know ahead of time, so it's not only for you, it's for everybody else out there that's going to be making presentations
you,
in the future. good. Okay. Are there questions? Representative Wilson, did you have a question on this? Representative Newman? Okay.
No, I'm just glad to see that this is going on. This is all my district. So.
Right. And, you know, I'm happy to see us looking at the lakes and the water quality in those lakes and trying to figure out where we are. I think it's very, very interesting that the Cook Inlet has had a major problem with the Susitna drainage not producing salmon and constraining commercial fisheries down in the lower end that really aren't even fish that are going to the Susitna. I mean, constraining other fishing because there might be some intercept, and yet on your summary page here we're seeing that Fish and Game sonar counter shows 92, and in just the lakes that you checked, it was 120. So obviously the sonar counter that Fish and Game has installed has been undercounting by, you know, probably half. Because here we're looking at 50% undercount, looks like. But difference between 92 and 120,000 actually counted fish. So we'll have to get with Fish and Game and find out whether that count is also used as their estimate, or if that count is a raw count and then they adjust that for some factor. Representative Newman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that was an interesting comment that you brought up. And although that shows that the estimate at the Yentner River, to the mouth of the Yentner there near the inlet, of course that Yentner is a large river down there, very dirty water down there, so it is difficult to do that. But the year before that, it was at 32,000. The interesting part of that cyclic information is the year that it was 32,000 2 years ago was the
commercial fishermen in Cook Inlet, in the middle Cook Inlet, or lower Cook Inlet, had record years of 5.8 million fish. Last year, when they had less fish, they closed off the center of the inlet for more time for fishermen. We did get a larger escapement up into the Yetna, so I think there is a direct correlation to that.
Well, Representative Newman, it's pretty hard to say that one is directly correlated to the other, but it is, this data is showing us that at least the Yetna count is undercounting, at least in this one experiment. Now, that's what would be good about having 3 years of data, if we're finding that we're undercounting from 120 actual counted fish going through weirs in not all of the lakes, and yet the sonar is only showing a count of 92, then it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it may be quite variable. It may turn out that next year they count less than what shows up, you know, but it's very interesting to see this relationship and see how that goes.
And you're right, you're very right, Mr. Chair, on that, and the fact that, and that's exactly why this study was forwarded. They're doing much more than just counting fish here. They're doing genetic studies, they're pulling scales, they're doing a lot of information gathering. They're going back as far as 10 years. Then they can look at fish on different commercial boats too, see where, what rivers and streams that they're coming from. They're gathering a tremendous amount of information and not just traveling a fish here. So a lot of genetic studies. Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I don't see any other questions, so I appreciate that. And Gary, can you come up and introduce yourself and then just explain a little bit on the last page here on the financing of the project here, just for our clarification. And sure. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record?
Sure. I'm Gary Fondry. I'm the executive director of the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. There was some questions on the funding that we had received last year to run this project. The Department of Fish and Game had a request in or received $1 million to do their portion of the funds of the project. We had made a request for $500,000 additional above and beyond the $1 million that ADF&G had received to work with ADF&G to expand that project to include the productivity from the individual lakes. And we received $200,000 of that request last year. So we are still short $300,000 from completing the full 3-year study, and that's where we're at today. So.
Okay, and I appreciate that because you know, I had some very definite questions on the Fish and Game, the design of the study, and whether we're going to get, based on the questions they were asking and the data they were getting, whether we were actually going to get data to tell us that. And I've strongly supported looking at the in-stream and in-lake systems and trying to find out what we have going into each one of those lakes and what we have as far as water quality and where we have problems. And I think that gives us there. So I'm strongly supportive of going forward with this 3-year project, because I think that this is the component that is actually could possibly tell us something about where we need to be, whether we need to be looking at these things and saying, well, gee, we have a system here that's got a lot of pike in it, and whether it's, you know, whether that is, as Representative Newman was talking, is that really a factor, and maybe we can get some of those things, but we won't know those unless we are doing the limnology and the work in the lakes, as well as just enumeration and seeing where fish basically go from downstream. Did you have any contact or any part in the radio tag stuff, or is that's all Fish and Game?
Mr. Chairman, that primarily was the responsibility of Fish and Game. Our role was to watch for those tags when they came through the weir. And we did see a couple come through the weir, and that's as much information as we have on it. And that was what Trent had presented. So,
okay. Yeah, I didn't think that was part of your study, but yeah. I just wanted to. Was there anything else that you'd like to add on the effectiveness or anything, any of the questions that have been raised by the initial year of this study? And Anything else that we need to be looking at or checking? I mean, I know we've seen that we need at least one more automatic sensor. Is one additional automatic sensor going to do it? It sure looks like all of them ought to have automatic sensors, because otherwise we're just relying on people out there with a hand one, and that just doesn't seem to be a very good, when we're going to all the expense of doing this, what is the additional expense to have automatic antenna loops on each one of these weirds?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the automatic sensor is a real key piece of equipment to have available when we're looking at the large numbers of fish that are coming back. And then it's unfortunate that we cannot predict how many fish are going to come back on any one site at any given year. So having a automatic sensor on every weir would be the ideal way to do it. However, we recognize that those are fairly expensive. I believe it's about a $3,500 setup to get those up and running. They require
$3,500
on each weir. So, in
wait a minute. I guess I'm a little taken aback here. You mean the piece of equipment we need to make every weir automatic and functional to count all of these pit tags going through is $3,500, and we've got a total of 7 weirs, and you've already got them on 3?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, we'll have to get with Fish and Game, because it seems like that, at least to me, and I can tell that Representative Johnson is rolling his eyes in the same way. I mean, that's the thing that makes this most effective, and to short the project for $3,500 seems to be penny-wise and very pound foolish. So we'll check with Fish and Game on that and make sure and see if we can get those to be fully funded. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the life of this antenna? I mean, they're certainly not 1 year, 2 year, 3 year devices. I mean, what's the life on one of them?
No, Mr. Chairman, the antennas are fairly sturdy pieces of equipment, and they would last for quite a while. You could get multiple years out of them. I don't know specifically how many years they would hold up, but it would certainly be more than the length of this study.
That's my follow-up question. Well, are there any other of this type of equipment out there that aren't being used anyplace?
Those are the questions that we have been asking the department and have been working with the department to try to get the antenna on as many of these weirs as we can. It may also be that there's not any available right now to be installed in the area. So there's issues other than price that are out there, and I think that's one of the things that the department would be more familiar with than we are.
Okay. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many people does it take to set one of these up? I mean, is it just one person, or do they have to take several people out? I'm just trying to get a handle on the actual cost to have one and install it.
Representative Wilson, when we go out and set up a weir, it's usually with a crew of anywhere from 3 to 5 people to set the weir up and get it running. Once the equipment is set up and run in place, we have a crew of 2 people that man that weir and count the fish through. One of the reasons we're dealing with 2 people out there is because it's a safety issue. We don't want to send one person out into a field camp where there is a potential an accident could happen without anybody around. So we try to keep 2 people out there at all times. So.
Any further questions Representative Johnson?
Thank you. In your budgeting, what percentage is actually equipment, and what percentage is salary, and do you have any idea about that? Are you talking? It seems to be very labor intensive.
That is correct. I can't give you percentages on that. I could certainly go back and look that up and forward that to you later on. Most of the equipment purchases come in the first year, as Trent had indicated. After that, there is a lot of budget that goes towards contract stuff, such as flying up to the sites and getting our crews supplied with the food and material that they need to operate in a remote site. So.
Thanks, Gary. We appreciate that. Is there any other questions for Gary?
the world ended. Thanks again. And I think, do we have someone from ADF&G here? Yes. Sorry.
I'll put it just out of reach.
Good morning. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record, man?
Thank you. My name is Doug Eggers. I'm a fishery scientist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game here in Juneau. I'm not directly involved in this project, but I'm familiar with operational plans and some of the what happened this last season. We have other folks from Fish and Game on the line, I guess.
I believe we have Bob Clark and maybe Jim
Hasbrook.
Hasbrook. Bob, are you online?
Yes, this is Bob Clark. I'm a fishery scientist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Anchorage.
Okay, and is Jim Hasbrook there too?
Yes, I'm Jim Hasbrook. I'm the Region 2 Research Coordinator for Sports Fish Division.
Great. As you heard, we have Doug here, and he's going to fill us in with a few questions that we've had. Anyway, Doug, could you go ahead?
I don't have a formal presentation, I don't know how you want to proceed.
Well, maybe you could let us know some about the project that you guys had in the Susitna. Obviously, it's dovetailed with what Cook Inlet Aquaculture is doing to supply some monitoring of the tags that you guys put in. And sure. Then also there were several questions about antennas and costs and whether we should have automatic antennas on all those weirs or just have hand wands at some of them. Those are some of the questions we have right now.
Okay. Sure. I might just make a general observation is that these marker capture methodologies are really useful for enumerating salmon escapement on large complex river systems. And we have a long history of experience, and it's really helped us in many areas of the state get a handle on, particularly on Chinook salmon and other important species in these large river systems. So we routinely apply those in southeastern Alaska. There's, you know, the Taku and the Stikine River for Chinook and sockeye, plus a number of smaller river systems, Copper River, Yukon, Kuskokwim, and the Susitna and the Kenai now. I think the basic idea with the Susitna project is that there is three marking sites, the Flathorn, and basically the marking fish at that site and recovery them upstream, and allows us to get a population estimate of salmon escaping at that point in the river. There's also tagging stations at Susitna, at Sunshine, and Yentna, the two major tributaries, and then we can recover tags at the Sunshine and Yentna to get the estimate of the population at Flathorn. In addition, these weir projects upriver also give us abilities to tag fish and enable us to make further estimates at Yentna and Sunshine. So there's a lot of redundancy built into this project. I think the weir projects are really important. In terms of this last field season, there were issues with some of the weirs in terms of not being able to look at the fish for pit tags. In addition, some of the weirs were not in, were pulled before the run was over with, so we got definitely incomplete assessments. So those issues can definitely be corrected in future years. I just might add that the preliminary data indicates a fairly large salmon escapement, sockeye escapement in the Susitna River system, probably much larger than what our Yentna sonar is telling us. So you're correct there. Again, I think the numbers are incomplete. We haven't had a chance to. There's a lot of data analysis associated with these projects. There's we may have to stratify and do other issues that require substantial analysis data, so the final data is not available yet. Okay.
I guess I have a question just from the data that we have here. If we've got like at Shell Lake, we have 66,000 that went by and we basically didn't recover any of those tags. How, when we're not getting a very good sampling of those tags, do we do a population analysis of how many, of what that population size is when we know that many of the lakes we're not getting any sample back from?
Well, it's my understanding from, is that two of the weir systems had very large runs, and also they were well sampled. I think they were Larson and Chilatna. Which one? I'm sorry. Maybe the poor fit guys could chime in and help out here. But
Larson had 56,000. At least the data we had 56,000 fish with 693 tags. Judd had 40,000 fish with 51 tags.
I think that now I've got the Larson weir and Chilatna weir had fairly large populations, escapements. They're also well sampled, and there are a large number of tag recoveries, and so those can be used as recovery samples, so we can get an estimate, particularly at the Yentna site, from those data. Now, it would be certainly, you have a better estimate if you use all the weirs as recapture sampling events, and I think we anticipate being able to do that in future in later years as we deal with the tag detection issues. And I think there were a small number of tag recoveries because we didn't look at very many fish. You have to get the wand fairly close to the fish, so you have to handle individual fish or pass the fish through the antenna to get effective sample. And this didn't happen in some of those other weir systems this last year.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize for not being here at the beginning of this, but I was at a finance meeting. And this might have been answered. The tags that can't be detected through the weirs, or
well, these tags are not visible. They're injected. They're internal, so they have to be detected electronically. They continuously emit a radio signal that actually the antenna interrogates continuously, and when it receives a signal, it registers that the tag is detected.
But they have to be pretty close.
It has to be within
the antenna.
Maybe Bob or Jim could answer this, but I think it's within a couple feet of the fish. Okay. And so, and another issue was why you didn't install antennas at some of these smaller weirs. If you have it's economy of scales thing. If you some of these smaller weirs where there's a small number of fish, we actually trap and handle all the fish, and it might be more efficient to use a hand wand in that situation. I think the problem last year with Shell was that there were just so many fish that they couldn't handle that many fish. So the antenna where the fish pass through that is much more efficient in that situation.
And there is a picture in one of these where it shows kind of the wooden box. I don't know if you were back here, and the antenna is a loop in that wooden box that the fish pass through, and so it automatically detects those.
And once,
like those RFID.
And once these weird situations are operational, they're tested continuously by passing tags through, no number of tags through the detector to check them and in the Kenai and other places where they've been used for a longer time period, they get virtually 100% detection once they're installed and operated.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. do I understand that each tag has an individual, like a serial numbers,
so you can identify the specific fish, not just a number?
Yeah, you can identify the specific fish, its length, its other biological characteristics, where it was tagged. So that's the beauty of these pit tags. We do this. We can use numbered Floyd tags and things like that, but they're
here. Just a minute.
Excuse me.
You've got to go back when you're talking about Floyd tags and everything okay. else. You remember we're talking to
right.
A wide audience that's listening to this. So would you go through? We had a little definition of pit tag, but explain what a pit tag is, how it's employed, Floyd tags, and the radio tags, just for the all of us.
Okay. Well, the radio tags are, I think they emit a radio signal just like the pit tags, but they're much larger, have a larger battery, and they have a range of detection as the order of kilometers. So you can scan from an airplane, you can set towers on the side of the river, and you can actually essentially detect all the fish, radio tagged fish that are migrating past that tower site. So
Representative Wilson.
I take it that they're a lot more expensive or something, so that's why we don't do it with all of them?
That's right. They cost about $200 a piece, and so we can only deploy a few of those.
And they're much heavier, right?
They're much heavier.
Yeah, so they might influence fish behavior.
That's right.
I see.
Et cetera. Representative Wilson.
And then you said
they're about this size, and they're injected in the stomach cavity, and the antenna hangs out the mouth.
Wow. Now, you mentioned the bat. How long does the battery last?
On the radio tags?
Yeah.
I think they last a year or so. So certainly they last as long as the fish is going to live.
So if the bear eats the eats the whole thing intact, we'll be following the bear around for a while.
That's right. That's right.
Representative Johnson.
Go ahead. But the pit tags are much smaller, there's a small battery, and they're injected into the either the body cavity or the cheek cavity, I believe, so they're much less intrusive, even, and there's less handling involved, and so there's a less of a tagging effect with the pit tags.
And we were told those are about the size of a grain of rice and injected with just a needle, not having.
That's right.
And it's hanging out or anything else.
And the recovery process is much faster if you have a good antenna and you can pass the population through the recovery process. Whereas with the Floyd tags or spaghetti tags, they're like a closed tab or something like they're actually pinned into the back of the fish or threaded through the dorsal fin. So we have to pick up the fish and read the tag and record that and everything. So it's we have to get our hands on the fish. We can't use a passive detection process with those.
So we're talking about a streamer in that case, or that's something right. that can be seen and may have markings on it, or numbers or something else. But it's basically a streamer that can be visibly seen.
That's right.
Representative Johnson, then Representative Wilson.
On the radio, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the radio tags, are they recoverable? I mean, is there a system that we could actually, at $200 a piece, I would think, I don't know how many you deploy, but I could almost see a cottage industry of people going out and finding these radio tags and returning them for reuse.
Right. In application of radio tags, we certainly make an effort to recover the tags. Sometimes they're caught in the fishery, and we try to recover those. We ask fishermen to return them to us, and if we return them, we can reservice them, put new batteries in them, and use them, reuse them, and we try to do that to the extent possible.
But it doesn't take many hours of fish and game personnel out there trying to track down a fish on a stream to eat up $200.
Well, Representative Johnson. And what I was thinking is that if there was some kind of a reward system that, you know, someone with a radio receiver could go out and find these things, there might be an opportunity to that it doesn't cost us, but for $25, we might get a $200 radio tag back. So I don't know if that's a possibility, but I like to recycle and save money where I can.
Representative Wilson.
You mentioned that with the radio tags that you actually can tell the length of the fish. Did you say that, or did I misunderstand what you said?
Well, we know we measure the length of the fish when the fish is tagged. So since we can identify that fish, we know its length. We can't measure. We don't use a tag, the radio tag, to measure the length.
That's what I was thinking. How could you do that? Okay.
Yeah. So it's just that there's a unique number, and that number corresponds with the data you collected earlier. So I guess I'm a little confused. Here at Larson, we show 56,000 fish and 693 tags. And here at Judd, we show 40,000 fish and 51 tags. But of course, at Shell, it had 60. The biggest was 69. It was higher than Larson in one tag because it didn't have that other. And at Chilatna, we had 13,000 fish at 81 tags. So it seems to be quite variable, even for getting Shell, between like Judd and Larson. Did Judd not have a automatic recovery system, automatic antenna?
I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe
Judd did have an automatic antenna. Yeah. So the tag versus catch return in those two systems is about, it would be about 600 for the same number, 600 tags for the same number of fish that you're getting in Larson versus 50 tags for that number of fish in Judd. So if we're not sampling all these lakes, how are we making that correspondence that the other lakes, Shell, whether Shell was like Larson or Shell was like Judd, if we've got that much variability?
I don't know this may not be the right answer, but Judd, one of these weir systems, it was way up in the river system, and the fish were fairly late getting to the, and so the weir was shut down before the marked population actually arrived at the weir. So that may be the reason why the fish are underrepresented in that particular sample. We didn't sample the entire run. The weir was closed. The timing differences between the weir operation and the fish, I don't know if that's the right answer or not, but and there could be a detection problem that the antenna wasn't installed properly or something of that nature. So,
okay, Representative Wilson.
I guess I there again, you might have gone into this, but if you knew that was the testing just for a certain amount of time, and so that you couldn't, if the fish were late, you just pulled out? I mean,
well, I think.
Go ahead and come back forward and reintroduce yourself there on the record.
Trent Dodson, the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. Yeah, Representative Wilson, we were dealing with students, and we had to pull our crews were students, interns. We had to pull the weirs out at a certain time so they could get back to school. I did have some discussions with Fish and Game about that. We do need to keep the weirs in later than what we did. We recognize that, and through my application process this year, we are going to try and hold the students till at least August 31st. It is suggested to at least go in a week into September, and so we as a full-time staff may have to go to several of the northernmost weirs and man them ourselves for a week or so, and so we can get a better count. That's something that we did as far as pulling the weirs out at an inopportune time for Fish and Game. So we recognize that, and we're going to correct that this year.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know part of this is the information process that we're using, but is there a different timing? I mean, does the whole sockeye run go at once, or do different lakes return at different times? I mean, have we been able to get enough information to say that one lake returns first in an order, or is it like everything at once? Do we know that yet?
Well, there certainly exist differences in run timing between lake systems. In addition, there's a time lag it takes a while for the fish to migrate from the marking site to the weir, and I think this is a case where the weir was way up in the river system, and it took a number of days for the sockeye to migrate from Yentna to, as Judd in the Yentna system?
Yeah.
Yentna tagging site to the weir.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, do it.
is, and I guess, you know, it's almost like a computer, garbage in, garbage out. So if the downstream process, if we happen to tag a lot of fish that's timed for that particular lake system, that would account for, could account for consistent, you know, variation in the lakes. I guess the question is, does the tagging shut off? I mean, what is the time period there? Do we have enough sufficient downstream tagging of the fish and stuff to make sure that when they get there, it doesn't make any difference if we pull the weirs or not. We just didn't, maybe downstream didn't do it.
That's a really important issue, and the tagging study is designed to, we want to put tags in equal proportions to the population migrating past. So we essentially operate, we try to put wheels on both sides of the river. In Flathorn, there's actually four wheels to cover the entire migratory corridor. We also tag continuously 24/7 through the whole run. And that's our objective. So it's definitely important to ensure that the tags are,
Reverend Johnson.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, the garbage in, garbage out scenario, you're confident that the information you're feeding into the system is adequate. You're not missing any. There's no blanks or any holes at the bottom end. And so the refinement needs to be up at the top end. Is that a fair assessment?
That's correct. And we also look for, we actually examine these marking proportions over time at the recovery sites to test that hypothesis that there's equal proportion of equal marking probability. And if we're unable to verify that, we can do higher order analyses to correct for those biases. But we look at the marking proportions over time. We look at, you know, differences in link frequencies between the tagged fish and the recaptured fish to see if there's any biases.
Follow up.
I'm trying to get a handle on the accuracy of the information. Has there been enough information to correlate that maybe fish don't migrate this way, but in this particular tagging operation, the fish seem to go here? Has there been anything, you know, to a particular lake system? Is there any way to do that, or is it just the fish go where they will as the water levels that year? I guess I'm trying to get a correlation on the backside too. Once you counted the fish up at the lakes, do you go back and look at where that was tagged, where that fish was tagged, and what particular part of the river, and et cetera?
That's right. Well, that's one of the objectives of the radio telemetry study, is to get the distribution of spawners throughout the river system, not just the lakes we have weirs on. So that's the main objective of the radio tagging, is to get spawner distribution and to tell us if there are areas where fish are spawning that we're not looking at in terms of weirs.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, a couple of questions. First of all, in the initial study and the proposal for statistical confidence, there were supposed to be 500 radio tags, and then I understood that was cut down to 100 radio tags. Did that take it out of the statistical significant portion when we cut by one-fifth the scientific design of the radio tags?
I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe Bob or Jim might address that.
This is Jim Hasbrook with Sportfish in Anchorage. I don't recall that we were ever talking about 500 radio tags being applied in any one year. I think it's more a matter of 500 radio tags being applied over the length of the three-year study so that we get a good handle on spawning distribution of sockeye salmon in the Susitna watershed.
Okay, we'll look into that. And I guess the other questions relate to what came up here at the meeting earlier. Are we being very penny-wise and pound-foolish if we don't have automatic antennas at each of these weirs? And Doug, I guess that's for you. Your fish and game representative is sitting before us.
Well, I would agree. I think the recovery detectability issue is a real important one, and you need to particularly with the weirs, after you've invested all this money in installing and operating the weirs, it's really important that you look at all the fish actually look at it and make sure that you're able to detect the tag. If the tag is there, you need to be able to detect it. So I would agree that that's an important consideration.
And does Fish and Game have those, or have they budgeted in their upcoming budget to provide those antennas? And is that $3,500 per weir the approximately correct number?
Mr. Chair, we talked with Mark Ouellette of Fish and Game recently, and he thought that was a pretty safe number. I think $2,500 or so for the actual antenna, and then about $1,000 or so to have it. They're run by a solar panel and that sort of deal, and so I think that was where the $3,500 came from.
Okay, and we need to have you identify yourself for the record again.
I'm sorry, Trent Dodson, Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association.
Okay, and Jim or Bob, I'm not sure who's the right person to answer this question, but we'd like the response from Fish and Game as well.
This is Jim Hasbrook with Sports Fish and Anchorage. Mark is the one who's been purchasing and installing these antennas in the weir, so he has a much better idea on the cost of those than I do. The department doesn't have extra pit tag detectors lying around that we can use in other regions or in of the state, so we would have to purchase new ones, but we're only looking at purchasing 4 additional pit tag detectors, so I think it's doable.
Okay, well, if for some reason you don't have that in your budget as something that you have budgeted for, we want to know and know why, because it doesn't seem like when you're putting $1 million into something and you got $2,500 or $3,500 that means that the information is less usable. From our aspect, that doesn't sound very good. So we want to make sure the people around this committee, there's 3 of us here now, and we're all in perfect agreement that we want to make sure that that goes forward, just because of the information that we've seen. And, you know, if we had Shell on here, that would really help us being able to look at the variability of these higher production. Can you also give us some relative idea of your estimate of the either the production or the escapement that goes to these buyers, Chilatna, Hewitt, Judd, Larson, Shell, and Stefan, versus the entire system? What proportion of the system do you think that we're looking at there? And this is the Fish and Game.
And this is Bob Clark with Fish and Game in Anchorage here. I don't think we know that yet. I think that's part of the radio telemetry part of the project, is we'll be able to look at the numbers of radio tags that go into lakes versus those that, say, spawn in side channels, these river-spawning sockeye. And I think at the end of the 3-year study, we'll have a really good handle on what proportion might go to lakes versus not lakes, and how variable that is from year to year.
Okay, so are you saying that we have all of the major producing lakes being sampled here by these weirs, or are there other lake systems? What proportion of the lake systems are we looking at?
Yeah, again, this is Bob Clark, Mr. Chair. The places we have weirs on that Mr. Dodson was discussing, especially if we add Stepan Lake on the main stem side, I think you'll be covering pretty much the major producers that go into lakes.
Okay, and Gary, would you come forward if you had something to add to this? And go ahead and reintroduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Gary Fondry with Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. I believe there were some studies done a number of years ago that looked at some of the productivity from the Susitna River system, and the lakes that we're looking at are probably, at that time, were estimated to be 80-85% of the return to the Susitna system. There is one other lake that I'm aware of that does have a sockeye run into it that is up there, and that's the Trinity Lake system up there. It's actually Trinity Lake and Movie Lake, two lakes together, that does on occasion have a substantial run of sockeye that go to it. And we're aware of that because we regularly fly the area looking for beaver dams that are holding back fish. And that is one of the systems that we have a significant amount of beaver dams on and see fish held up on a fairly regular basis.
Okay. Anyone else have a question here before we go on? I did want to get some information on the beaver dams because we had talked about that earlier in the meeting. Does anybody from Fish and Game have anything further they wish to add? Okay, well, we appreciate you. Representative Johnson.
Are we getting ready to be done, or are we going to move on? Because I do have a conflict meeting.
We're getting ready to be done. We're just
Might I, before we go, and I guess this is a little bit of soapbox, I think everyone on the committee is in agreement that we shouldn't sacrifice the data for a piece of equipment that is, in really the overall scheme of things, quite inexpensive. And if they need 4, 5, 6 of these, I would think that would be a very good place to spend your budget money, as opposed to maybe something else. If you're going to scrimp, and I understand money's tight everywhere, but if there's a place where you're going to cut, I would encourage it not to be in that equipment. Please get that stuff. I mean, I think that's just my opinion, and I think it's hopefully shared, but once again, garbage in, garbage out, and if we can't read the data, we have to be confident that the decisions we make are based on good science. So spend the money. You'll probably never hear me say that, but but this is one case where it's important that we do get good information. So
and
if you need 10, get them.
And Representative Johnson, one thing that we do need to note is that this upper work, the stuff in the lakes, the entire report that we've got today is a 3-year project,
right?
But we didn't fund the 3-year project. If there's $300,000, which is to Cook Inlet Aquaculture, which does all this upper work. Fish and Game is not doing this work, and they haven't put it in their budget. So if we do not do this, they may be tagging and doing their fish wheels and stuff, but we're not going to get any recovery of data. If, as right now, there was a $500,000 for the 3-year study, we did $200,000, but that's all directed at the recovery of information. And so if we don't fund that, I think we funded the Fish and Game study, the downstream stuff, but the recovery of data is not only the antennas, but the people to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we know if that's does that budget live within Fish and Game? Is that a special capital appropriation? Where does that live?
Let's ask Gary, do you know where that was funded last time?
Mr. Chairman, that was a legislative grant that came directly to the Aquaculture Association from the Department of Community and Economic Development.
So that was a specific name grant in the budget?
That's right, and
make sure that's there.
Yeah. I think that if we're not going to recover the data, there's not much use spending $1 million downstream to put tags in if they're not going to be recovered.
So, I agree.
One other thing we're talking about on this, I know the Susitna is very important to many people around this table, and that is in their district, or a lot of their people participate in fisheries up there. Could you tell us just a little bit, Gary, on the beaver dam issues?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The Aquaculture Association has run a program since I've worked for them, which started in 1990, to regularly survey areas for beaver dams that are holding fish back on their spawning runs up to the nursery lakes. This has been a chronic problem in the Susitna River for a number of years. It's been particularly gotten worse over the last 3 or 4 years because of some warm, dry summers. In the past, we would generally find the fish backed up behind a beaver dam, go in there, notch the dam out, allow the fish to go forward. The beavers would repair the dam in 24 hours, and you really couldn't even tell we had been there. In the last couple of years, on these warm, dry summers, where you're getting fairly warm temperatures, we're seeing fish that are not able to survive behind the dams. And we have seen, on a couple of occasions, significant mortalities of the fish that are going up into the nursery lakes, the spawning lakes, to spawn. And that has occurred before we can get there and open up the dams. So,
just clarifying, you said behind the dams. You mean below the dams, or do you mean above the dam?
Excuse me, below the dams, downstream of the dams, is where the fish are being held up. And when you get a bunch of fish blocked up behind the dams and the temperatures are very warm, their respiration rate is higher, there's less oxygen in the water, and the fish tend to suffer accordingly.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, this is off subject, but I, as kind of keeper of the room, I do need to let you know that there is another committee meeting scheduled for 10 o'clock for this room. So this is great information, but I do sort of have another responsibility here.
Appreciate that. We didn't realize that there was another meeting. So that is really good information on those beaver dams. We'll need to be looking at that, both from Fish and Game, because we've had the reports up in the beaver expansion up to the Nome area, and there's no procedures up there for taking care of those, I don't think. So is there anything else? Seeing nothing, we will be adjourned for the day, and thank you very much.